This is WBAA. I'm Greg Kostraba on the phone with Garrison Keillor, creator, host, and producer of A Prairie Home Companion, which is coming to produce Elliott Hall of Music for a live broadcast Saturday, October 27th. Garrison, thanks so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule.
My pleasure.
WBAA, we're celebrating our 90th anniversary this year, and you're celebrating almost 40 years of live weekly radio broadcasts. What do you think brings people back to the radio time after time and year after year?
I don't know, but I know what brings us back to doing show after show after show, and that is a sense of unfulfilled perfectionism. And the show never comes out quite right, and so we keep at it. If it had been a better show at the beginning, we would have stopped and gone on to something else. Frustration is what brings us back. The audience, I don't know. I think maybe they have a sense that they're likely never again to be able to see a live radio variety show, that there just aren't any more of them. And that may well be true. When we do the show at Elliott Hall of Music, we'll be on the air live around the country and around half the world. And there will be, with the Glee Club and Old Crow, and on it goes for an hour, 58 minutes, and whatever happens, happens. There's no post-production.
Now, was it the live aspect of radio that got you interested back when you started?
Well, those shows had died out long before. I grew up listening to them, live Saturday night barn dance shows, and then I went down to write about the Grand Ole Opry for The New Yorker back in 1974. And it did interest me. There was the liveness. There was a vitality about the Opry and an excitement among these old performers, Roy Acuff and Minnie Pearl, and you could tell that this was different for them than an ordinary concert. They really got ginned up for it.
Did you find that there was a niche needing to be filled? Is that why you decided to start Prairie Home?
No, I started it because I thought it'd be fun to do. And I had been in and out of public radio and had been a writer and bouncing around doing this and that. And I thought I'd like to give that a try. You know, sort of my last hurrah in radio before I retired to a farm to write the great American novel. And instead, I fell into this pattern of chronic work.
Well, it doesn't seem like work to us, which means you're doing a really good job. Mixing storytelling and skits and music like you do now, was that kind of the thought at the beginning when you thought it would be fun to do that kind of mix? Or did you envision something different at the beginning and it just kind of evolved into where it is now?
It started out as a music show. It was a musical show, mostly folk and blues and a little bit of old parlor music. And then I wanted to be more than the MC standing up there introducing people. And I started writing commercials for it, for Jack's Auto Repair and Bertha's Kitty Boutique. And Powder Milk Biscuits was early on. And I wrote those and did them. And people seemed to like them. So then I started telling stories about a small town called Lake Wobegon. It took us a long time to get into sketch comedy. I don't know why. Before we started bringing in actors and forming this radio company. But once we did, we knew it was the right thing. So it developed slowly. It had no plan. We had no real ambition to carry it on at the beginning. It was just something you did on Saturday night with a few people you knew.
When you mentioned the radio actors that you have with you, they are such a large part of the show, and they're so enjoyable. How did you get folks like Tim Russell and Sue Scott on board?
Tim Russell did an early morning show on commercial radio in the Twin Cities, and I heard a recording he did of A Christmas Carol, in which he did the characters Scrooge and Cratchit and all in and different voices, and I really was impressed by his voices. I'm even more impressed now that I've worked with him for all these years. Sue Scott, I also heard on the radio. She did some things for Minnesota Public Radio, and she was a natural addition. Fred Newman, our sound effects guy, I met years ago. He had a book out called Mouth Sounds, and he was on a book tour, and I was impressed, and it just took me a long time to put two and two together and get him to do the show. He does amazing vocal effects of all kinds of horns and explosions and every animal from Noah's Ark on, and all sorts of other things, meteorites and mutant pterodactyls and demented walruses, anything you want, singing dolphins. So those people really, really make the show. And whenever Fred Newman walks out on stage with his white hair, the audience just perks right up.
And the house band, which is spectacular. Did you always have a house band? You mentioned you had folk and blues artists on early on. Did you have a group of musicians there, or was that something else that developed?
I always had a band. There was a little string band that started out, the Powdermilk Biscuit Band, and then a jazz band, the Butch Thompson Trio. And when the show came back from sabbatical in New York, we had a 13-14-piece band called the Coffee Club Orchestra. And then coming back to St. Paul, we put together the Guys All-Star Shoe Band, all centered around our music director, Rich Dworsky, who is an amazing, intuitive improv player who can do anything whatsoever.
You'd mentioned the commercials that you started and the news from Lake Wobegon, and now you've got Guy Noir and Dusty and Lefty and a whole rash of other characters that you have to create stories for every week. I mean, storytelling is a huge part of A Prairie Home Companion. Can you tell us a little bit about the process that you use to create these stories?
Well, I think it always starts from something in real life, and it starts here and now. And it starts with some little thing that you notice or something that's going on with you. I'm thinking now about the news from Lake Wobegon on the show this week. And I have a friend who is mourning for a dog who died. And that's interesting to me. And a friend, a woman I know who wonders if she's going out of her mind. These are things that one mulls over, and somehow you pull it together. I have a friend who is very he's very worried about the fact that 2 days ago he went into a restaurant and couldn't find his car keys and went back to the car, and there were the keys in the ignition and the car still running. To him, this was like the end of the world. Well, maybe this is a story for Guy Noir. I don't know. But it always starts with some little thing like that. Then you sit down to write, and you follow it. It sort of leads you on. Either it leads you on, or it stops dead, and you put it away, and you try something else. It just all comes out in the writing. Stories tell themselves, and there's no way to force them whatsoever.
When you're on stage and you're telling these stories and you've thought about them, you don't have notes, right?
I don't. It would be distracting to have notes. What you want to do is listen to yourself. You want to be able to hear what you've just said and spin it out. You don't want to have this reminder in front of you of what you might have thought a day ago. It's not going to be of any use to you at that point. There's no need to write a speech. If you mean what you say and if you know something about it, you'll remember what you need to remember.
Right. And I was asking that because I thought either A, you have a prodigious memory to verbalize everything that you've written down, or you have an outline in your head and you just kind of wing it when you're on stage. And it sounds like the latter.
I have an idea in my head. You wouldn't ever want to get up in front of an audience and not have an idea. It would seem disrespectful. You want to have thought about it, but you want to have this be an experience for the audience and for you at the same time. And when you are winging it, they are with you. They really are with you in a way that wouldn't be possible if you were standing up there and reading off a piece of paper.
Two more questions, because I know your time is limited. First one is probably one I should have asked a while back, is way back at the beginning, with radio variety shows kind of dying out or being dead by that point, how did you convince the powers that be that it would be a good idea on a Saturday night to give you and your bands and your characters some time on the radio every week?
This was back in the early primitive days of public radio. It was before there were any vice presidents. It was before there were any people who knew anything. We were just all amateurs and idealists, and you know, they had to fill the time somehow. It wasn't hard at all. Nowadays, it would be impossible. You would have to have some kind of a plan and a mission, and you would have to write a 4 or 5 page proposal. And there would be meetings, you know, at which people would argue the merits. I never would be able to do that. But back in the old times, Minnesota Public Radio was a small, struggling outfit. It probably had about 12 full-time employees. Everybody was working endless days, and it was kind of fun. I walked into the boss's office, and I think it was about a 5-minute meeting, and he said, sure. It seemed like a good thing to have on the radio right after the Metropolitan Opera broadcast on Saturday and before the Boston Symphony Saturday night. Nowadays, it wouldn't go.
It's just so much different now than even when I started 18 years ago.
Everybody got smarter, and there were a lot of meetings. You see, we were too busy to have meetings back then. You just were working your tail off to put stuff on the air. So there was no time to sit down and discuss things. You just did them. Radio was self-erasing, you know, and if you made a mistake, well, you know, 5 minutes later it was gone and forgotten. And now, you know, people sit around long tables, as they do in the real world, and there are endless discussions. But there are people who are very smart sitting around long tables in small rooms whose ideas are not that good. They're just very good defending them. There are people who triumph in meetings who don't do all that well out with normal people. And that's an old veteran talking.
Which leads me actually into my last question, which is, if you don't sit around with long tables in small rooms deciding, say, who's going to be your musical guests, and you, as you pointed out, Purdue Varsity Glee Club and Old Crow Medicine Show are guests on the show here at Purdue October 27th, how do you go about selecting the artists, both national and local, that appear on the show? What do you look for?
Well, we look for people who we think would enjoy being there, first of all. I'm not so interested in promoting any kind of music or promoting somebody's career as I am in having a wonderful time on stage. That's really what I look for. The hard work, you know, is all on Friday and to some extent on Saturday morning. And by the time you come to broadcast time, it's supposed to be fun, and those are the people who I want to work with. I want to work with people who I would have fun with on stage. I have all sorts of colleagues who listen to CDs, and you know, by the truckload, and who get around and hear people, and they stick their head in my door, and they say, listen to this, and I think these people would be good, and sometimes I agree with them, sometimes I don't, but it really has to do with having a good time. I don't carry a brief for any kind of music. I just like to enjoy myself.
Garrison Keillor still having a good time with the Prairie Home Companion, coming to produce Elliott Hall of Music for a live broadcast Saturday, October 27th. Ticket information is at convocations.org or at 494-3933. Garrison Keillor, thanks again for taking some time out of your schedule to talk with us.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.